Hello, and welcome to our new podcast here at SAHS for Black History Month. I am Ever Allen Hood, and I will be hosting this podcast with Mr. Sable and Mr. Sanders. Today, we three have come together as a pilot episode, just as a Kickstarter, and we hope whoever tunes in to this podcast enjoys. So, first off, why not we just start off with some self-introductions, starting with Mr. Sable?
My name is Mr. Sable. I'm the math department chair. And the moderator for the newspaper The Eye and for the podcast club.
And Mr. Sanders?
I am Mr. Sanders, the Assistant Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, as well as the Director of Reaching Majors Program and the moderator of the Multicultural Student Union.
All right. So to start off, I'd like to know what led you to this school, St. Ignatius High School, meaning not what you did here, but like what before?
I got my introduction to St. Ignatius High School via the Midwest Talent Search back in the sixth grade, and I came here to take an ACT as a sixth grader. And then from there, you know, kind of caught the eye of a lot of people. It was a lot of high school juniors and seniors here, and then there was this little guy in the sixth grade taking the ACT, and I was actually in Mr. Becker's classroom in the math wing. That would have been in like November of 2004. And then from there, I was also connected through a couple board members that my mom knew, and they were talking to her about kind of the Majors program. And so shortly after that experience, I kind of wanted to know a little bit more about this school, and ended up enrolling in the Reaching Majors program.
So the Reaching Majors program occurred even before this? I mean, before when I came to Majors?
Yes. So the Reaching Majors program has been around in a few capacities over the last, you know, decade or two decades, close to now. And it was just the Majors program, which is an exposure program for underrepresented students on campus. And so we were able to bring students in to campus, and we did some overnight retreats and things like that. And that got students interested in the school. And then when students began to enter into the school, there was, you know, concerns of academic preparedness, so on and so forth. And so the program was able to grow and expand, become what they call the Reaching Majors program, which is an academic enrichment program. And then, you know, some things have changed about the program. Some things we want to add back into the program from the days of where it was an exposure program. Like, I would really like to bring the overnights back. Of course, we can't do that this year. But those were great bonding activities between the high school students as well as the students in the program. But the academic components are showing huge successes. And so that academic enrichment program that you went through is expanded, right? I believe after you weren't a part of that first fifth grade class, were you?
I think I was.
Okay, so you guys were the first fifth grade class. But you know, that's a huge benefit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not just in terms of you thinking about the academic exposure, which is phenomenal for students and that academic opportunity, but then selfishly for like us as a school, right? We begin recruiting you in the fifth grade, so I get 4 years to brainwash you for you to want to be here, right? It's phenomenal for me.
All right. I'll switch over to Mr. Sable. Before you came here, what led you to become a student at St. Ignatius High School?
That's a good question. You know, to be honest, my path was pretty typical for a lot of students that came through here. Both of my older brothers were students here, and you know, just the example of seeing them and talking a lot about the stories that they came home with day to day really made me, from, you know, early age, look at this place as you know, the obvious goal for me. It wasn't the high school decision wasn't really much of a decision, just because it was the place I always wanted to be.
So you had a legacy of older brothers,
yeah,
and maybe even a father.
Not my dad. My dad went to Benedictine, which, you know, for all intents and purposes is, you know, roughly the same idea. You know, he might as well have gone here on that level. Not that it's like the same sort of legacy in terms of the institution, but I guess you could say the legacy in terms of expectation or in terms of, you know, family or cultural idea of what high school is supposed to be.
Speaking of Benedictine, my own father went there as well.
Oh yeah.
And yeah, he didn't finish it, but he always wanted me to go to an all boys school as well. Originally, he was bent between Ignatius and Benedictine because he had such a close history to it.
Okay.
But ultimately he saw that Ignatius offered a lot more to me in comparison.
Yeah.
As many may know, I'm a senior here at St. Ignatius High School. And before I found St. Ignatius, I went to a variety of grade schools around Cleveland. First, John W. Raper and Thurgood Marshall. And then Wade Park, part of CMSD. And finally, Metro Catholic. And it wasn't until fifth or sixth grade where I became introduced to St. Ignatius through Maja's program. And in eighth or seventh grade, I got into SCP. And so being so close within the programs that we have here for before high school, that's how I got introduced and inspired to come here. As a student, once you came here, was there anything that called you to become a teacher or to go into mathematics? Or did this feeling come naturally?
To be honest, it did kind of sort of come naturally. I remember being a junior and kind of realizing that I really wanted to teach math and I wanted to teach it at Ignatius. Going through college, I was sort of open to other possibilities. I always kind of figured one of the mantras of my life is that, I'm probably going to be wrong, or there's a good chance I'm wrong. So I kind of went in thinking that, you know, I got to be open to other possibilities. Very, very rarely do people kind of realize what they want to do young like that and stick through with it. But as it turned out, I was still into it by the time I was done with college. So I did a few other things in between, but yeah, ended up, sure enough, come back. I taught for a year at Cleveland Central Catholic before coming here, but yeah, I was here, and actually, I think it was my very first year teaching here. Mr. Sanders was one of the students in one of my classes. So, there you go.
He's pretty sure. I'm 100% sure.
Well, I think it was my first year.
He was
what
first
I'm saying.
Year teacher.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was in his first period.
That's right. You and
no, not first period.
It wasn't first period.
Right after lunch. For me.
It was right after lunch. It was Mrs. It was in Mrs. A's room.
Yeah.
And was KJ in the same section?
You had a bad section.
Mrs. Johnson.
Me. It was
yeah,
KJ.
Yeah, yeah.
KJ or Mr. Johnson, as known in our community.
That's right.
Tyler Hammond.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh
yeah,
my
yeah.
gosh. It was Raymond Caraballo. It was a motley
oh,
crew.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh,
you
yeah.
guys are good guys. I remember.
I'm glad that's how you remember.
No. I legitimately remember, you remember kids from your first year better than the kids from last year sometimes.
Yes.
It's very interesting the way that goes.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's interesting as a student here, just seeing how connected the generations come and go. It's also just fascinating to me how often students come back just to see one another again and reteach what they learned. And how they got inspired to be a teacher here as well.
No, there's something about those beautiful words of ties of new days from the old as written in our alma mater that lives through and through with the blood life of the school. I mean, you have folks from multiple generations and we connect and we respond to one another. We recognize one another. I was telling a story the other day. I was flying home from doing some work for the Modest program in New York and I noticed someone, you know, who is a good friend of mine. I mean, his mom works here at the school. His name's Mark Tupa. And so we ended up sitting really close to each other on the plane. But I'm sitting down talking to him. And then from behind me, I hear, "Well, hello there, Mr. Sanders." And I turn around and it's none other than Mr. Dominic Ozan.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, boy, we're so closely connected. But I mean, that was just one flight. And there's been other times where you're like in the airport and I've got like an Ignatius bag or a shirt or hoodie on.
Yeah, airports are good places to find other people that went to Ignatius.
In Charlotte, St. Louis, it's been great. It's mm-hmm. been great. And I mean, we recognize, we know each other, and we have a common bond. So,
yeah, definitely. So shooting off back to you, once you came here, was there anything that called you to become the director of Majus or spread the diversity and inclusion within the school?
Oh man. A lot of this stuff is just organic and passionate for me. Right. So like, I don't think that I have a job. I'm able to live a vocation, that I love. Right. And I use those words very intentionally. I don't show up here every day to do a job. I show up here to do something that I love and give back to something that gave so much to me. And so whether it's from, you know, people who introduced me to service and social justice, i.e. Mr. Hennessy and Mr. Evans, or someone who helped foster my relationship with the school in the beginning, i.e. Mr. Jason Reed or Mr. Trace Altoff, in terms of the director of admissions and reaching Majus and multicultural retention services while I was a student here. To be able to walk in their footsteps and continue that work is a lifeblood privilege for me, right? And so, you know, to be able to expand the programs and ideas that were given to me that allowed for me to have the amazing student experience that I had, it's a privilege to do this work. And so it kind of happened organically. And some of the stuff that I do now, I think echoes some of the work that we were able to do while I was a student. I was very involved in the school and DEI efforts, and, you know, nonviolence and social justice awareness efforts while I was here, while also playing sports. And so to be able to, you know, foster that and promote to you guys to do whatever you want to do, it's a blessing, and it allows for things to really come full circle.
Compared to your student years, how far has Black History Month changed, for better or worse?
Oh, that's interesting. I think even in the time of which I've been working here, I don't know that we do as much, right? We were doing a lot of things. And it's no knock to anyone who was leading these efforts, but it wasn't a lot of engagement from the overall community, right? I mean, we were holding fantastic events and brought in a lot of speakers, but it still felt siloed off. Mm-hmm. To where, like, I didn't even host trivia last week. You know what I mean? Like, Mr. Luisi hosted that out of campus ministry, and the history department is doing a timeline. I wasn't even thinking about bringing out the shirts. You know, I sold polos this year, but people have been asking for this stuff, and they want to be a part of the conversation and sharing other people's stories, and speaking and allowing for students of color to see themselves within the curriculum. And that for me is so rewarding. Right, it's one thing to come for me for advices and best practices on some of this stuff, but to see people really embrace the work of allowing students to have an identity across campus, and see Black history across campus is phenomenal. And that's like today, you know, with the Chinese New Year celebrations, almost everybody participated in that today.
Yeah, those are really fun,
right?
I think.
And so every student would have got the red envelope, right? And although that falls in line with Black History Month every year, that growth of kind of institutional awareness to say, wait, there are students who are different here, but their experience is just as valid. And to embrace their culture, their traditions, and share that with one another only makes our community richer.
And the cool thing about the way that high schools work, and this place is no different, is that It's every 4 years, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you have your experiences when you're a student, I have mine, and you work here, so you see a huge arc with the however many years you've been here. But, you know, you talk about how Black History Month seems different now than it did a few years ago. But to EA, I mean, or to any student who's a freshman or sophomore, that's all they know. That's what their experience is now, you know? Mm-hmm. And now that's how they experience, that's how they think. A lot of them assume that's how it's always been, right? Which is obviously not necessarily the case, but that's the nice thing about the way this goes. You know, high schools have short memories when it comes to that.
Yeah.
You know, and now it's part of the identity.
I think it's, who tells me this? Milton told me this. You know, every year we can reinvent ourselves here. We have that grace, because you're going to get a different class, right? So our freshmen have no idea about what we did last year, right? But you also don't know anything about what we did 5 years ago.
Right.
Right. And so you can speak to what's happened and the changes and the things where you might have seen growth over the last few years. And so to see people really engaging, and last year I started this cultural and identity celebrations committee. And so that's really allowed for a lot of cross campus and cross departmental collaboration, that I think is really, really healthy in terms of thinking about the celebration of each other's cultures. That's where you get the prayers and stuff and mentioning of the saints from campus ministry. And then you have some events that are still looking to confirm for the month where we're partnering with theology and campus security. You have some opportunities happening, like I said, out of the history department. Welsh Academy's handling, you know, some of their own things. And to see that growth of folks having that invitation to work together, I think has been phenomenal to really push the collaborative efforts for A, more effective events and programming, but B, ones that are, you know, are a lot more, are much more highly attended. And so the first week of trivia, we had 34 students play. Yesterday we had 61. And so for next week, we better see like 90 something and continue to see things grow. I mean, we don't have to hit that, right? it'll still be successful. But ultimately, like, to continue to see these things grow and students have fun when learning about each other and engaging each other's cultures is the goal.
So would you say that it was a lot more fun when you first came here experiencing Black History Month through the school, like, as a student kind of getting hit on with that? Or do you prefer in your position now where you're kind of controlling it maybe not control is the right word, but
leading some of these efforts is that I would much rather just be experiencing every day. I enjoy the privilege and responsibility of being in a leadership position. It's something that, like I said earlier, I don't take lightly. It's, you know, I sit and hold and think about a lot of this stuff at home at night, like, hey, did I do this right? I want to make sure that the work that I do is quality for your experience, right? Because even though you guys change every year, what I gave you is what I gave you. And if I don't position the work the right way, I could leave a bad taste in your mouth. And that's not what we want to do. And so, you know, we take these things very, very seriously, all the work that we do here. And that's complete of this community. That's one thing I will say about working here, is that the level of detail and collaboration, but then also kind of your personal due diligence is something that I hold and cherish from what I've learned in my time being employed here. We don't just do things for the sake of doing them. There's always a multifaceted variable behind the work that we put in here at Ignatius.
Has the other months, like Hispanic Heritage Month, Asian American Month, have they happened before my time here, Ignatius, or are they relatively new compared to Black History Month?
There's been some kind of one-off celebrations in the past. A lot of this stuff wasn't consistent. And once again, that's no knock to anyone. It's just A, you know, what are students asking for at times? And then B, you know, what's feasible with the calendar and other responsibilities of the persons who have held this work in the past. And so I think we've been doing Hispanic Heritage Month for close to 5-6 years now, that I know of personally. And there's things that could have happened while I was absent from the institution. But like Women's History Month last year was our first celebration of that. I know there's been some Lunar New Year celebrations for a number of years now as well. But like Native American Heritage Month, I think this is the first time as a community we've ever celebrated that. But, you know, when you get people working together in collaboration, you know what I mean, like with this, the CICC committee that we have, you know, you can foster that. Like, I'll be the first to tell you, I'm not the person who should recommend the things that we should be doing for Native American Heritage Month. Although that is a part of my lineage, it's not one that's dominant for me, and I don't want to misrepresent a culture. And so that's where, as you see our school diversify, we open ourselves up to further opportunities for that, because I don't ever want to misappropriate someone else's culture. I'd much rather have you there to speak to it, and I assist in facilitating the celebration of someone else's culture.
I'll give the question off to you, Mr. Sable. So compared to student years, how far has Black History come?
From when I was a student?
Yeah.
To be totally honest with you, I would have to assume extremely far, because I have absolutely no memory of it as a student. in an organized fashion, any sort of deliberate celebration of diversity didn't exist. And that's not to say that people didn't care about it, but it wasn't at the point where it was organized in an institutional way like this. Do you know what I mean? The Majes program didn't exist. It was probably, when I graduated, it was probably about a year or two right before it really started kind of coming together with people starting to work on these issues more deliberately.
As I heard from other sources, that it did take until maybe around the 21st century that Black History Month really started to facilitate within private schools. So
probably, yeah, that makes sense, roughly, yeah.
Compared to other subjects, math is kind of hard to add on to the push for diversity and inclusion, because it's compared to history, it's, you can easily just make a lesson regarding Black history, or in the case of theology, you can always give a prayer or a theological truth about it. But math, it's kind of hard to put in regardless, even if it outside of diversity and inclusion, to just insert that, like,
yeah.
So how could, or has the math department aided in the diversity and inclusion for the school?
Well, so I to start out with, I kind of disagree that it's a subject that seems like it has fewer opportunities, maybe, as other subjects. I think that there's actually a lot of opportunities to include, you know, lessons and conversation about issues that have to do with Black History Month or have to do with diversity and inclusion. You know, man, there's so many different ways you can look at this. I mean, just the idea of the way that we experience data and numbers in our world has a lot to do with the way that people understand issues of diversity and therefore social justice and a lot of other issues, right? And I think that in a lot of cases, there are a lot of really good opportunities to break those issues open by talking about that data, by talking about the way that it's reported, by talking about what it means and how to interpret it, right? Now, the hard part is that depending on the course, sometimes it's harder to find the right time to talk about those issues mm-hmm. and kind of keep it aligned with everything. For example, you're a student of mine in Calc. You know, I could do a better job of incorporating a lot of issues into it, but it's a little bit harder in Calc and maybe also because of the pace sometimes. And that's kind of a bad excuse, but it's my excuse. But I guess just for my own sake, I'll talk about too, like almost the same week in pre-Calc, we were talking about finance and finance math, talking a lot about personal finance and these kinds of things. And we had a good conversation about redlining in Cleveland and redlining in general in the housing industry and how redlining was used in the 20th century to kind of create segregated neighborhoods, essentially, because we're talking about mortgages and talking about how people get mortgages and how credit happens, right? And that was a good opportunity to do that. The analysis course that Mrs. Reagan's running this year talks about social justice issues constantly because they're talking about data and stats. And there's just so many good examples that we can do stuff with there. Now, so here's the thing. There are a lot of really good opportunities to do that. Are we all doing a good job of it? No. And I'm not like calling out my fellow teachers because I'm not doing a good job of it either. You know what I mean? So we could always do better. But I don't think that we have a pass because we're math either. You know what I mean? And I don't know. And this is maybe sort of more of a philosophical level, but on some level, the way I view math actually intersects a lot with the way that a lot of the issues that we're talking about can be viewed because, I view math as a subject where there's a lot of different ways you can approach a solution or a topic. I view math as a process where, you know, the final answer is one thing, but the way you get there and the way you discuss how to get there and the way you describe how to get there and the process is another big part of it. And not to say that like the work I do in math is equivalent or as important or is the same as the work towards social justice or diversity, equity, and inclusion. But I think there's actually a lot of parallels. And I think that there's a lot of lessons to be learned about the sort of arc of how all this stuff works and the way that, you know, I view the way, you know, you can break open a problem. And that might sound kind of weird, but I see those as being very parallel.
No, I fully understand. Yeah. I didn't think of it like that. Like, I didn't apply the statistics and the data to math as I do with Black history and whatnot. So... yeah, I can see how a class like Mrs. Reagan's interprets that, or a class like economics.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, like yeah, for calculus, that'd be kind of maybe jarring even.
Well, I'll tell you what though, there are some ways you could do some of the stuff we're doing in class. I won't get too much into it just because Mr. Sanders might kick us out of the room. But there are some ways that calculus can be brought into this stuff as well. But I mean, some of it's time and some of it's just trying to find the right time. But also, I'll take ownership of it too. I mean, I could just do a better job of it,
mm-hmm.
you know.
But on an individual level, it's probably a lot easier to do it individually. How have you helped aid in diversity and inclusion? I know we're on the Challenge Success team,
mm-hmm.
which both directly and indirectly aids in that. So other than that... what else have you been involved in that might help lead to that?
Nothing specific, or I'm not, you know, I don't work as a moderator with MSU like Mr. Sanders does. I don't work as a moderator for example, like Ignatian Alliance, like Mrs. Reagan does and some other people that I work with. So I don't have an official capacity in that. I try to support as much as I can. Mm-hmm. I try to be open. I've worked with Dr. Richardson Phillips, not worked with, but, you know, participated in a lot of the programs that she's offered. Over the summer, we had a cool book club that I learned a lot from, and some other programming that she offered last year for a lot of the faculty and staff. I've been really excited by the work that she's been doing over the past, 2 years that she's been here, trying to take as many opportunities as I can to kind of learn from her and kind of learn what her vision is for the school, the institution, in terms of what her office is doing. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to support her work. I'm trying to learn from the work, learn from the opportunities that she's providing.
Yeah. And I think with us and Chunk's success, that'll be a huge part in the coming years for even more diversity within the school. Regarding Dr. Richardson Phillips, ever since she's been here, I felt kind of at ease knowing that there's somebody who's taking initiative to really push for a more diverse culture within the school.
Right. Well, and not to Mr. Sanders, and this certainly wasn't your intent, I know, but... You know, the work Mr. Sanders is doing as well. And, you know, I don't know if you would agree with this, Mr. Sanders, but the way I view the kind of difference is that, you know, your work is so important with the way that you work with the students, right? And then her vision is a little bit more like she's, you don't have to worry so much about the adults directly, right? Except as it pertains to the students, right? But that, she also has her finger on like trying to shepherd the adults kind of through this process.
Like a funnel.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Sure, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, like we're open to talk about that. Our working dynamic, I mean, for it's a department of two, right?
Yeah.
But our work touches every piece of the institution: advancement, alumni engagement, athletics, counseling, the academic departments. You think about the Modest program as an entity of itself, the Welsh Academy. Mm-hmm. And so I take no offense to, you know, the comments, because it's true.
Yeah.
I stay out of kind of the policy,
yeah,
the hiring, the strategy things, which for me is kind of a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, it lets you to focus on the stuff you do best.
Yeah, in my interim year, it was some things that, you know, I didn't avoid those conversations where we needed to have it with HR, X, Y, and Z, and advising with Father Ray. But ultimately, like, shoot, I was burnt out. You remember that year, Everett? I was tired all the time.
I know.
Because, you know, there's so much of student needs that come around as we're learning and growing, right, within our culture. And so, you know, that's very important to be a student advocate, work with counseling to kind of build that relationship and rapport, you know, help parents understand that they have efficacy and voice here just like everybody else. And so those are all things that I was managing. And so allowing her voice to come in, and then also for me to be able to lead and learn from that. Mm-hmm. There's things that I teach her about our culture, right? But then there's things that she's teaching me in terms of just DEI strategy and her visions that I needed that guidance as well. So I appreciate and love and cherish that leadership in terms of a supervisory role. The feedback that I get, the professional development offered, it's allowing me to grow further as a professional and building my identity here with the work that I'm charged to do. But also keeping very clear distinctions that, you know, like her and I can't afford to be in the same meeting unless we have to. You know, we got enough work to do between the two of us. So it's awesome. It's awesome.
Yeah, I hope to have her on the podcast soon, because I feel like a lot of students don't even know her name, mm-hmm, and how much of a cornerstone she is in my eyes, I think. So more to Mr. Sanders, but you can comment as well, Mr. Sable. What role does the Welsh Academy play in the future of St. Ignatius High School?
Welsh Academy for me is us looking at kind of the origins of St. Ignatius High School. St. Ignatius High School is founded for underprivileged students that live in the Ohio City area of Cleveland. And so when I say that, we're looking at, you know, 1886, where this is a very Irish, German, Italian immigrant neighborhood. And during that time period, those persons were, I mean, in more than one way, oppressed within American culture. And lack of educational opportunities was present in this area. Lack of economic opportunities was present in this area outside of, you know, like the physical labor, right? So this is an area where a lot of your tradespersons works, and a lot of your, you know, folks who might have working in the salt mines or, you know, in railroad cars, as you think about kind of this stockyards area that sits around us. And so this was a very underprivileged, underserved area. And so at our origins, we sought to educate those Irish, German, and Italian students, right? And I would argue we've done a pretty darn fine job at that. And so Welsh Academy for us commits us back to the area and the city of which the Jesuits usually commit to. And so we are what they call a Jesuit legacy school, right? And so by Jesuit legacy, it means that we were founded, you know, 100 plus years ago, unlike the newer schools and the Crystal Way Network or so on and so forth. And so as a Jesuit legacy school, most Jesuit legacy schools sit in an urban metropolitan area and had a commitment to the city. And that's one of the things about Father Welsh is that he committed to keeping us in the city. There was opportunities to move Ignatius to the suburbs. And so he kept us in the city. And if we're going to be in the city, it is our thoughts, our thought and our goals are to educate the students within the area of which we serve. And so the Welsh Academy is a refocus to that origin, which I think will further help diversify our student population, but then also ultimately allow us to just kind of commit back to that origin. Not that we're off track of mission or goals or of that, but it's a specific focused goal for a certain demographic of students who are underrepresented and underserved throughout the city, and that is the Welsh Academy. I think some of that language is actually in their mission statement.
I'll be honest, I did not know that side of history, that it was kind of, it's kind of coming full circle with St. Ignatius High School trying to aid the oppressed in a society. It's kind of like, looking at it a little bit racially, it's kind of ironic that among a majority white nation, that its own probably considered white peoples were being oppressed, you know, if that makes sense.
Excellent. That gets really into the origin of what it means to be white, right? And that has changed over time, right? And there's no concrete definition. And this really gets into some critical race theory stuff, but it's not something to where, like, I normally even like to say white, right? I want to know your national origin, because when you start removing that away, you remove some of the individuality of the person, mm-hmm. right? And I mean, some people would argue, you know, like they don't want to be called African American, they want to just be an American. I'm okay with the modifier, right? I'm African American, I'm a Black American, whatever you choose to call me, that's cool, outside of a couple things that we're not going to say for this sake. But ultimately, like, those modifiers make it real and personal. So when we talk about our Irish American history, our German American history, our Italian American history, that is a personal connector. And I was having this conversation with a colleague here in the building today, like, how do we begin to get students to see some of themselves in this oppression? I said, well, you got to take it back to their story, right? There's been oppressive forces. I mean, and the Black experience has always been different, and it's been particularly cruel in terms of when you look at oppression here in the United States. But ultimately, there's been other communities that have been oppressed within the United States. Asian American internment, the way that the Irish were treated upon arrival, Italians, so on and so forth. And so when you allow folks to see themselves within that oppression cycle, it then makes it a little bit easier for them to connect to the current struggles of people, right? So if I can talk about, you know, the way that a lot of our Irish, Italian, German Americans were able to receive opportunity based upon the GI Bill and other things, and then you can parallel that to the denied access to opportunities for the same African Americans who fought in the same wars, then you can start to make it real to where it's like, oh, you know, well, Black folks have been oppressed in the United States. Oh, well, you know, Martin Luther King gave a speech and they did some marches and Barack Obama was president, so it's all good. No, there's systematic structure there and economic, social mobility, opportunity criteria that have been denied so that there's that oppression still exists. And so like that's one thing for it to be like a standard, right? And so, I mean, and I don't want to put any onus on Mr. Sable. Like he said, it's kind of like the standard. His older brothers went here. He came here, right? That's regular for his family, right? And because that's their opportunity, but within their privilege. But like for me, I'm the only one of my five brothers who went here, right? So I'm an exception. It's not a standard. It's an exception. And so to say, oh, Mr. Sanders did it. Anybody can do it. No. I don't like the fact that I'm still a part of the exception, right? I'm exceptional within that, but it's still an exception as opposed to being the standard, right? And so that's where when you add those modifiers on for everybody, it allows for that distinction to you to make it real, to like, you know, you're a part of this equation too.
Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to...
I'm sorry if I deviated.
No, it's fine. Question. Because I think it's important to celebrate the fact that... This current coin term, white immigrants, that have been oppressed have found their salvation almost in America in a way. Like for example, Irish American History Month is next month, and that'd be cool to have podcasts set aside for. But our focus.
Let's talk about it. Keep this going.
Our focus as a culture should be to always help the oppressed. And to celebrate those that have been free, because why not both, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's easy to talk about what's hard about the Black experience right now, but there's a wide variety of races that we could all accept and cherish and flourish in when we start to talk about actual ethnicities rather than just Black and white, you know?
Yeah.
Because Black and white are indeed a very huge umbrella term, and they'll never, as terms, cover the whole story.
Right. Like, you and I have very different privileges, opportunities, and struggles being Africans displaced in America versus African immigrants in America, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have a completely different, you know, a whole different diaspora. We may get looped into being Black in America altogether, but their world looks different. Afro-Caribbeans that live in the continental United States, right? Their experience is so much different than ours. And so it's different things there. That's where like I'm like all for the modifiers. Let's talk about it. You know, I've got a really good friend who's Afro-Caribbean, and you know what I mean? Like, their family has so much land and things like that because they were able to fight and earn their freedom, to whereas here, it was a much longer process and struggle. So, I could talk about this all day.
And even Haiti, especially.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Haiti, things that happened in Jamaica, and so families who were able to acquire land in Jamaica and make it sustainable, and then, you know, able to move to the continental so they keep working the land and develop multiple streams of income. Like, that's real for a lot of people. To whereas, like, you know, my grandfather had to run away from a plantation at 15. And, you know, we don't know our family. And so he came to Cleveland with nothing, built, you know, scraps of things to, you know, provide a life for my mom. And then, you know, she was able to go to college. So I'm not a first generation college student, but like, you know, now I have a little bit more opportunity than that. And then, like, let's look at, because of what I do, what kind of opportunities can I open up for my kids? You know what I mean? And so it's all about what happened with the generations. And it's a lot there. It's so much history. But that history all coincides with the fact that, you know, there's some things that were oppressive. And there's some things that, you know, where we have some privileges now. But what did it take to get there? And that's a part of people's story. So that's what's interesting about this medium. You can sit and have these conversations. People can share their stories to where, like, I'm a second generation college student. And I don't want to speak for it, but I think like Dr. Richardson Phillips is like a fourth generation college student. That's phenomenal. So in terms mm-hmm. of that emphasis on education and her family, it's been there for generations, right? That's strong. That's beautiful. And that's probably one of the reasons why at 27, she's got a PhD, right? That's a beautiful thing. That's something to hold on to. But that's different people's stories. And I think you capturing people's stories and sharing that while talking about these cultures, it allows for you to make the conversation real for people outside of things we might just see in a textbook that we're not, you know, attached to. I'm Mr. Sanders. You see me in school. I lead some events around. I do X, Y, and Z. So hearing things from my story, Mr. Sable's story, that makes this opportunity really real for people. And so I appreciate you putting this together. This is phenomenal.
No problem. Mr. Sable, you did say you have brothers that went here and,
yeah,
and whatnot.
Yeah.
That, like, to me, that sounds amazing. I think it's really fun in a way that you can look to somebody in that light and try to go bring yourself up to their level or even higher.
Yeah.
So, and I appreciate that this school does hold legacies to such a high degree, because that's also important in the statement. I just hope that at the same time we continue to push forward diversity and inclusion to include more people of different backgrounds to have that same experience.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, and like I'm aware of the fact that you know a white kid from, you know, suburban South Side or whatever, the Cleveland, the South Side of Cleveland. I grew up in Seven Hills. There's no shortage of you know brothers from those families who are coming here, right? I went to school at Loyola, Maryland, which was a great experience. I loved it. It was a great school. But, you know, probably a pretty similar sort of diversity makeup to Ignatius, right? And one of the guys I worked with there, Rodney Parker, ended up becoming, I forget exactly what his title is, but a guy who ended up becoming an administrator worked a lot with diversity, equity, inclusion there. I was reading an article that he kind of wrote in the Alumni Magazine, and he recognized that one of the key features of what he measured as success at that institution was that there were now siblings that were coming through the school that were siblings of students of color who had come, you know, a few years ago that he had helped shepherd through the school. And the fact that their younger siblings now also chose that school was just such an honor to him and really a sign to him that, like, I'm doing good work. I'm having success here. We're kind of making progress. And I think it's such an interesting metric for you to bring up, because I think that's exactly right. And not just that, not just siblings, but parental legacy, you know, which mm-hmm. exists definitely not as much as it could for, you know, the rest of the student population. But I think that those are actually huge metrics to look at.
No, you know? That's huge. And that's something that is real for us. Yeah. I mean, like, with several alums that we have, we're beginning to see that, and we've seen some already. Like we had the opportunity while I was here, and the alum's son, who would have been in my class, ultimately ended up choosing to go to another high school, right? But you know, we could have experienced that in 2010. With this year's incoming class, we have a multitude of that. I think we have like three or four alums of color who's sending their sons. We have some in the freshman class. That's excellent. We've seen it, you know, with other families, and I don't want to name folks just because, you know, it's their families, and they, I don't, like I said, I don't like to air people's stories for them, but ultimately, like, we're beginning to see that, which is a fruit. It's a fruit of the labor. Mm-hmm. We're even seeing it within the Welsh Academy and within the Modges program. So it's phenomenal.
Just a curious question: are there any staff members that are like, I don't know, father and son? Kind of thing. I know there's a few husband and wives, but
yeah, there's a few spouses for sure. Yeah, what father? There have been a few that I can think of.
Yeah.
A few faculty, the Einans too. Mr. Einan, his dad actually used to work for Plant Services.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Betts, his mom was an English teacher here. Oh, wow. When I was a student.
You got the Brennans here.
The Brennans, yeah.
Yeah. Let's see.
There's a lot of...
Joe Mertens. His mom used to work in cafeteria.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's right.
He's here in communications. So you see that.
Jackie Lee Ivy and her daughter. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's... I mean, her daughter's here.
Yeah.
So you see it. A couple other examples. I mean, like, I don't want to start getting into people's marriages
yeah.
and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
like, people, you know, are married into other folks' families from the community. Like, it's a fully interconnected community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's a lot of student teachers.
Yeah.
So that's cool too.
Yeah, we're very much a family business. We're very
It's a family
for better or for worse.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember when in first grade, no, first or kindergarten, my aunt was my teacher, mm-hmm. and she, instead of being spoiled, she was strict. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I personally have that experience of having a family member as as a teacher.
There have been some cases where some of the people in my department had their own kid in class.
Yeah,
it's not ideal, but it's not the big.
It happens.
It happens.
Mm-hmm. It happens.
And it's an experience for sure. But well, to close off, is there anything you two'd like to add to that you'd like others to know?
I kind of wanted to jump into this earlier. Math and DEI fit very well together.
Oh, so yeah.
I'm doing this MBE thing right now with a couple other folks, so it's a professional development opportunity. We're talking about the connections between MBE and DEI last night, and so it's huge, but particularly in math, like Majus, right? We're for family day, everybody's got projects that they want to present. I don't know if you remember that from your time in the program, but like, you know, all of our students are presenting on a black mathematician for the sixth grade unit, right? So if this airs before that, that means that the families will know what their sons are presenting. Yeah. They were surprised. But ultimately, like, you know what I mean? Like that was their project.
Yeah.
And, you know, another class is like working on activists and things. And so you have all these interconnected things. You know what I mean? Like Dr. Euphema Haynes, somebody who was a part of our Black History Month trivia, mm-hmm. right? She is a mathematician, got her degree from Catholic University, her PhD. Right, that's huge. But then also they fought for education equity for years as a mathematician. And so the opportunity for you to sit and take calculus with Mr. Sable comes from a black mathematician, mm-hmm. right? You gotta remember Katherine Johnson, who put men on the moon, black mathematician. Benjamin Banneker, black mathematician. And so mathematics particularly has a strong space in terms of the advancement of colored people.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so, Mr. Sable, I'm going to challenge you to look at some stuff you can do for that.
No, there's so many opportunities, and especially considering that, like, not only are there opportunities we can take advantage of, but I also recognize that it's important just because math is often a huge barrier. It's a huge barrier for a lot of students, but disproportionately for students of color.
Yeah.
There's no question.
Yeah.
And I'm aware of that.
Oh, no. We'll start really getting into the systematic oppressions, and then we'll be here till 6:30.
Yeah. Well,
Everett, you ready to stay?
Well, that's what I was thinking about this earlier, how I think African-Americans now are being interested in STEM, but I don't see a lot of push towards mathematics.
Mm-hmm. It's hidden, though, right?
Yeah, it's probably there.
So, no, yeah. Like, both two of my best friends, right? They're both in STEM.
I'm in STEM.
I mean, yeah. But, like, I'm like, trying to go real world. Like, Everett, they're coding.
Mm-hmm.
They are calculating. You know, like, one of my best friends calculates airfields, right? That's mathematical equations that I don't think I'd ever want to understand. I really don't want to, right? And so, I mean, like, but it's hidden in these other places. So, like, one of your classmates is looking at going to Purdue for aviation technology. The biggest thing about that kind of aviation technology program at Purdue, it's really just a math program.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so you disguise it, but a lot of this coding stuff is math. When you think about social media and marketing, that's mathematics and analytics, you know? Analytics is a growing field. That's math. And I mean, persons of color are really blossoming within this space. And so math is a lot more complicated than just the basis of, like, saying, oh, I'm just a math major. And you got to think financial math, so on and so forth. And so it's integrated throughout our culture. I mean, I think it's a lot more embraced than what we publicly like to share.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So maybe African-Americans do integrate themselves in math, but in other forms rather than the most obvious.
Oh, yeah. I got to look at math every so often when I got to check the budget or enrollment
numbers. Yeah.
Well, it's definitely getting better than it was, but there's definitely still different disproportion.
It's definite disproportion, but that just gets into the whole education equity and so on and so forth. That's where programs like Majus and Welsh come in and are able to, like, close that opportunity gap.
I nearly forgot my mom was an auditor.
See? You know what I'm saying? It's not sitting up there like, oh, yeah, I was a math major, but, like, she's basically a math major.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Sable. Thank you, Mr. Sanders, for being here. And I hope to work with you two again sometime in the future.
All right. Thanks, EA. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.